You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Oh yeah, it's a special day here at First Take. Needless to say, just looking at the screen, you have nothing to worry about in terms of your basketball knowledge. It's bad enough I'm brilliant myself. They don't call me Stephen Naismith for nothing. But then you've got Mr. Literal himself, the one and only J.J. Redick, who knows all things, everything about the round ball. And you've got the veteran, the man who's been around for ages, the savant himself, Tim Legler, in the house. If you don't learn basketball today, damn it, I don't know what's wrong with you. First Take's in the house.
Good morning. What's going on, everybody? Welcome into First Take. SA is on the West Coast. He had a quick flight out there this AM, but I got my guys. Tim Legler's in the building, looking clean. J.J. Redick, as always. Gentlemen, how we feeling? How we doing?
I'm great.
Yeah?
I'm loving it. This time of year is the best if you're a basketball
yes,
fan.
Yes, yes. It's not just going to be an NBA special, though. Stephen A., let me just say this quick. Keyshawn, Damian Woody will be here. Mel Kiper is going to be here to talk the draft, so there's a lot we're going to get into. Plus, you have an interview with David Benavidez.
One of the best in the world, if not the best in the world. I can't wait to talk to him.
Yep.
J.J., it's good to see you. Legs, you do know what it means to sit in that chair, right? You know what that means.
I do. I'll carry my weight. I'll try,
yes,
Steve.
Yes, sir. All right, let's rock.
Let's do it, guys. The Chicago Bulls prevailed 109-105 in double OT at the Wells Fargo Center to delay clinching the Sixers' sixth consecutive postseason appearance and snapping their eight-game winning streak. The loss came after the Sixers honored members of the franchise's 82-83 squad, marking the 40th anniversary of the team's last NBA title. James Harden struggled last night, though. He had 5 points in the double OT loss, his lowest scoring output this season, while shooting 2 of 14 from the field, 0 of 6 from 3. Harden's 14.3 percentage from the field was his lowest field goal percentage in a regular season game since 2015. Worth noting, Doc said after the game he thinks Harden's foot was bothering him. Stephen A., was Harden's performance a cause for concern?
Well, I'm going to say yes, but it's not because it's one game or anything like that. That can happen to anybody. I'm not going to overreact to, you know, a performance that's clearly an aberration, because this is James Harden we're talking about. You're not accustomed to seeing him scoring single digits or shooting 14% from the field. We understand that. I'm just going to say that there's a reason for concern from the standpoint. It's just a reminder of how important he is to the Philadelphia 76ers' aspirations this season. When you look at Tyrese Maxey, you know what to expect from him, but he's a young player, as gifted as he is, and I like seeing him as a starter, J.J. and Legs, more so than I like seeing him come off the bench. I think offensively he's more productive that way, but that's just my opinion. You look at Tobias Harris, the Shake Miltons, the Anthony Meltons of the world. Of course, we get Embiid's the star, Tobias Harris. We get all of that, but it all comes down to me, to James Harden. You're not beating the Boston Celtics or the Milwaukee Bucks in a playoff series if James Harden doesn't show up and gives you star caliber production. He doesn't have to be a league scoring leader like he was in Houston. But the James Harden that we've been seeing this year, damn near leading the league in assists and doing the things that he's been doing, you with his productive play and his sporadic play of offensive aggression, where he might drop 30 or 35 on you at the in a wink of an eye before he goes back to averaging about 21 a game. The reality is that you're not beating the two monsters in the Eastern Conference. I know Philly's one of them, but you're not beating Milwaukee and you're not beating Boston without James Harden playing at least a relatively elite level, guys. I'm not talking about, again, from years ago, but a relatively star caliber elite kind of player. You need that from him in order to knock off one of those two guys.
Yeah, Stephen, I agree with most of what you said there.
Okay.
And I think it is important to note Harden's role on this team versus Harden's role in Houston. And we discussed this a bunch last year during the playoffs. What does James Harden have to be for the Philadelphia 76ers to make a deep playoff run, get to the finals, and play for a championship. Mm-hmm. And I honestly believe he has to be the player that he's been this season, the player that he was at times at the end of last season. He's leading the league in assists. He's scoring 21 a night, efficiently, shooting over 38% from three. The reason he doesn't have to be James Harden in Houston is because Joel Embiid is so dominant. It's because of Tyrese Maxey. And I totally agree with what you said. Tyrese Maxey absolutely should be in the starting lineup, should stay in the starting lineup. He's a much better player. Across the board, his splits for the season, 22 a game as a starter, 15 a game off the bench. The efficiency numbers are much better. In the 11 games he started in March, since he came back to the starting lineup, shooting 52% from three. Harden needs to score 18 to 22 a game. But the facilitation on this basketball team, that's what's really important. You bring up something interesting to me, and that's for them to beat Boston, for them to beat Milwaukee, Harden has to be an approximation of what he was in Houston. And we saw that. We saw that 2.5 weeks ago at Milwaukee, one of the best games of the season. He had 38, 10, and 9, absolutely took over down the stretch. But the thing is, he doesn't need to do that every single game because there's enough of a supporting cast in Philadelphia, and Joel Embiid is clearly A1 on this team, and he has been dominant all season long.
So going last, this is great because I listen to both you guys, and I'm going to take some things that I agree with, some things I disagree with. Let's start with just the premise of the question. Am I concerned about last night? No. It's 1 of 82. He had a bad night. Their team collectively had a bad night. So did Chicago, actually. It's amazing they won the game because they didn't play well offensively. Mm-hmm. But so I'm not worried about last night, right? That's going to happen at times, particularly the way he has played for the last 2 or 3 months. I think this is the best version of James Harden I have seen as a point guard since he got to Philadelphia. He seems to have found the right balance of when to be aggressive, hunt my own, and when to be that facilitator to get people involved. So I love the way he's played. I'm not worried about last night. Now, let's fast forward to the postseason. Everybody knows, and JJ and I talked about this yesterday, very few people have been as skeptical as I have been about James Harden's ability to come through in the clutch. Like, will he be there when they need him to be in that big spot? Those series-defining moments, a 2-2 series, fourth quarter, one-possession game, is he going to be there for you when you need him to be? Is he going to have the same level of aggressiveness? Because I can point to a handful of times he has not. And it's not necessarily having a bad night. It's just taking his foot off the gas when he plays a certain way all the time. So I still have a lot of skepticism about that. And here's what I will say. Yes, he's got Embiid playing at an MVP level. Yes, he's got Maxey to help. The bottom line is this. Stephen A., I agree with you on this point. It does fall in his lap for this reason. When you get into a best of seven against the Sixers, right, there's going to be adjustments made to Embiid, where he sees the double teams come from. They hit him on the catch. They hit him on the dribble. His back's to the basket. The double teams are coming. He's a big man. He's going to have to give it up. James Harden, because of his escapability, because of his handle, his shooting range, his ability as a scorer, he's going to have those moments that they're going to need him to take over the game as a scorer and give them big buckets. And I'm still fearful that that will not be a moment that he embraces and seizes. And that's why I think overall it's a wait-and-see mentality for me. I love the way he's playing, but I still have these memories of other postseason performances in my head when they get into those tight spots. Will he be able to deliver? I'm still doubtful about that.
Well, it's interesting. I'm glad I got y'all both on, and maybe JJ and Legs, y'all can explain briefly in a moment why Maxey was ever coming off the bench, to be quite honest with you, because I think it's a clear distinction between what he does as a starter and what he does coming off the bench. I don't understand that. I understand he was supposed to provide some spark or whatever off the bench. As far as I'm concerned, he's just much better as a starter, and they look better and more potent when he's in the starting lineup. Having said all of that, let me get back to Harden, and I'm going to throw this at y'all, and this is just a thought. I'm open to the fact that I can be corrected on this. But when I think about Harden, JJ, I understand. I say he's averaging 21, 10, and 6, and he's been productive in terms of his efficiency, and I get all of that. That's what I pointed out. But this is what I believe transpires in the playoffs. You know Embiid's the monster. There's nothing you can do to him. You can only hope to contain him, okay? He's going to get his, all right? When you look at the other guys, certainly if you are a team and you're familiar with James Harden's history, think about who he has to go up against. If he goes up against Milwaukee, if he goes up against Boston, talk about Jrue Holiday, you're talking about Marcus Smart, you're talking about Brogdon, you're talking about Derek White, and these boys, these brothers play some defense. And so for me, when I look at James Harden, I can see a scenario, JJ, and I'll throw this to you. I could see a scenario where if you're an opponent of the Philadelphia 76ers, you understand how potent they could be, but your mentality is, we've seen what he's done in the past. Let's see what he's going to do now. And put him in a position where you're daring him, knowing that he's going to feel the pressure because he's going to be reminded of some of his, you know, hiccups and flaws in previous postseasons in his career, like Tim Legler brought up. You can see a scenario where somebody dares him, even though Maxey is younger, even though Tobias Harris doesn't have that load on his shoulders. I could see a scenario where somebody is saying, okay, we're going to key on these other things. We're going to dare James Harden to show us what he's got because we didn't see it enough in the past, in past postseason competition. And all I'm saying is he's got to deliver because we know he's capable of it. But he's got to get that monkey off his back, and he's got to answer the call because I think the other guys, particularly Maxey and Embiid, will answer the call. The question is, will he?
I want to add on a few things here. We should note, since Chicago got Patrick Beverley, they have been the number one defense in the NBA. And Philly has been solid defensively all season. That game at times was tough to watch if you're a fan of offense. To Legg's point about Embiid and the double team, while I agree to an extent, the adjustment that Philadelphia has made, in particular this season, is allowing Joel Embiid to operate in the foul line area, allowing him to operate in the elbow. And a lot of times in that pick and roll with James Harden, he's rolling not to the rim, but into that short pocket area and catches the ball at the free throw line. If they switch, he doesn't roll down to the post. He goes and posts at the foul line. Why is he doing that? It is much harder to double team in the foul line elbow area than it is on either side of the post. So that's an adjustment they made this season in particular, and that's going to make it harder to double team Joel Embiid, either on switches or on straight isolations. On Maxey, I've brought this up a number of times. The reason that he was taken out of the starting lineup was for defense. And some of that was coming off the foot injury. There was a minutes restriction early on. Yeah. They were winning with Melton. But the overall idea was we're going to have Melton in for defense. The problem with that is those two five-man lineups are Philly's two most used lineups, obviously. The Maxey lineup is 5 points better defensively per 100 possessions. And I think eventually, after a larger sample size, Doc and Philly figured this out. He's better offensively coming off the starting in the starting lineup rather than coming off the bench. And we don't lose as much as we maybe thought we would defensively with him in the starting lineup.
Well, they also were trying to stagger his minutes a little bit more with Harden because, you know, he was empowered and he was growing as a player. Now you bring in a guy like James Harden, they were worried about at times, can Maxey be suffocated and stifled off the ball as much as he was? So they wanted to see if that would work out. But there was a game against Memphis like 2 weeks ago. They played 5 minutes together, their three best players in the first half. And I think that's when it really was kind of like that moment where you go, wait a second, what's the point of having three special offensive players if they're not on the court at the same time? So they made that change shortly thereafter to get him back in the starting lineup. And now you've got that additional 20-point scorer. He's young, but he looks fearless to me. I'm not as worried about Maxey being able to handle the playoff pressure. Here's why I worry about it. When you compare him to the other two teams, they're going to have to get past. When you're talking about Milwaukee and Boston, you know, Boston has Jason Tatum, Jaylen Brown. They're the two guys that are going to have the ball most of the time. They've got live dribbles. They can beat you from every platform. They've got the ball. You look at Milwaukee, Giannis is going to have the ball downhill. When I look at the Sixers, the reason I say the pressure is still on Harden, he is still your primary ball handler. He's your primary decision maker. He's the guy that's going to have to be able to handle those tight moments in big spots in playoff series and get them through it. Hopefully he does it because he's been great for the last couple months.
Can I dive into the East and move this conversation forward here? I want to take a look at the You want to say one more thing? Go ahead.
I just want to say one more thing real quick. The thing about the challenge for Harden is that you have he got to make sure he weeds out the noise, because you have some people clamoring for him to be that offensive juggernaut that he once was, and you have others that are saying, like you're saying, playmaking ability. We all know what he needs to be. The point is, if he's hearing all that noise, which voice is he going to listen to? And that's where it could get potentially tricky in the postseason.
Yeah, too many voices can get convoluted for sure. We'll take a look now at the East standings, where it's very tight at the top. The Bucks lead the second seed by 2.5 games. A half game separates the Celtics and Sixers in the battle for the second seed, but both teams will still have their shot at the Bucks before season ends. Stephen A., which team needs the one seed the most in the East?
My personal opinion is that it's probably the 76ers. I think that the Milwaukee Bucks just won a championship a couple of years ago. They're championship tested. They believe that they would have been the reigning two-time defending champions if Chris Middleton hadn't gone down from due to injury last season. Their mentality is they probably would have beaten Boston. They would have taken them out in that six games when Jason Tatum dropped, I think, 46, if I remember correctly. That's their mentality. If you're the Boston Celtics, obviously you've proven that you can win on the road, because you've done that last year in that game six when Jason Tatum went berserk and then you closed them out in the game seven. And you're the reigning defending Eastern Conference champions. The Philadelphia 76ers, we all know how much I abhor the process. Tim Legler, you know this. You know this situation is near and dear to my heart. How they were throwing basketball games, as far as I'm concerned. They weren't trying to win for 5 years, for crying out loud. It was an atrocity. J.J. Redick, just so you know, I actually complained personally to the commissioner in the league office, because that's how bad it was when I'd be in Philly. As a guy that covered Philadelphia sports for 17 years, I was appalled at the whole process stuff. It just sickened me, okay? Well, guess what? You know what? They still haven't been to a conference finals. After drafting Embiid number 3 overall, after drafting Ben Simmons number 1 overall, with all of this stuff that was going on, they still haven't been to a conference finals since I covered the Philadelphia 76ers, and they went to the finals against the Lakers after beating Milwaukee in the Eastern Conference Finals. The point that I'm making is, when you look at it from that perspective and you look at the 76ers right now, they've been in the 2 or the 3 spot for the vast majority of this season. Milwaukee and Boston have been vacillating back and forth between the 1 and 2 spot. I believe in them more. I believe that Philadelphia, on their home turf, obviously a formidable period, but I do think it helps them to be at the Wells Fargo Center in Philadelphia in a potential game 7. I think they're the team that needs that number 1 seed more than anybody, and I don't think they're getting it.
Well, I think that all 3 of them, obviously, these are 3 of the best home court environments in all of sports right now, all 3 places. So, you know, they would all prefer to be in that spot. But if I had to pick one team, maybe it matters more to. I'm going to go with Boston, and it's more of a process of elimination. I look at Milwaukee. They won it. They got it done. They got that thing all the way across the finish line and won a championship. And they were in some tight spots during that run and in the last, you know, several years since the Giannis Antetokounmpo era really took off. They've been in those tight spots, and they have managed to win some of those really important road games, and they won the ultimate prize. They won a championship, so you can say now they've got championship pedigree. So I don't doubt them as much maybe on the road in a big spot. When I look at a team like Philly, I don't even know that it's that great necessarily, with all the games I've sat in over the years at Wells Fargo in the playoffs, and I know you have, Stephen A., and at some moment this guy right here next to me was playing in some of those games. The weight at times and the heaviness, right, that's in that building at times when the pressure starts to percolate, I almost think sometimes it could be more of a relief to be playing that situation on the road, right, because you can just sense it. And they're hanging on every single moment, particularly when you're coming off a situation. They just lost in the World Series. They just lost in the Super Bowl. No D1 schools made the tournament this year in the city. Everything is focused on the Sixers right now. It looks like they have a shot. You know, you get into those tight spots, you can kind of start to feel that in the building, and it's a lot of pressure. And I'm talking about a guy in James Harden earlier that I don't know navigates those situations that great. So for me, by process of elimination, I'm going to say Boston needs it. To get that number 1 seed, to know you've got those first 2 in every series, game 5, and then potentially a game 7 in that building, I think it's more important to the Celtics.
Here's a take I have, without answering the question initially. Philly's not going to get the number 1 seed. I don't believe they are. They're getting ready to go on the road. They've got at Golden State, at Phoenix, at Denver. They still got a road game in Milwaukee. They've got a home game against Boston. And then they close with the Miami Heat, who are battling for that sixth spot, the Atlanta Hawks, who are battling for that seven or eight spot, and the Brooklyn Nets, who are battling for that six, seven, or eight spot. So their road with three games back with 11 to play, their road to get there is extremely difficult. I don't think they're going to get the number one seed. To Stephen A's point, the path for the number one seed, and this is not a knock on Cleveland or the New York Knicks, the path to the number one seed to get to the conference finals is easier than if you're in the two or the three spot. And the path to the NBA finals is easier. Think about whoever gets the number one seed. You've got the Knicks or the Cavs in the second round. If you're in that 2-3 spot, you've likely got to win your first round series, potentially against the Miami Heat, who have been playing better lately. Then you've got to beat one of Philly, Boston, Milwaukee. Then you've likely got to beat one of Philly, Boston, Milwaukee. So that to me is the importance of the number one seed, which is why I say they all need to get it. They all need to get it. It's not about the past playoff performance of Milwaukee. It's not about being at home. It is, to me, about the path to the conference finals and the toll. We witnessed that last year in that Milwaukee-Boston series in the second round. Al Horford just talked to me about this. The toll of that series and then having to turn around and likely play one of Philly, Boston, or Milwaukee right after that. To me, that's why the number one seed is so important. I just don't think Philly's going to be in a position unless they just win all those games, which I mentioned all those teams are playing for something right now. That is not an easy route with 11 games to go and three games back in the standings to get the number one seed.
That makes perfect sense, JJ. I can't argue with that. What I would say, however, is that I don't diminish the importance of just imagining a game seven on your home turf. And I think that obviously that's the easy route people can take when they think about a number one seed and what benefits that come with that. But in the end, when you imagine a game seven in Milwaukee, when you imagine a game seven in Boston, I'm looking at teams like that, but then I'm also imagining them on the road. Philadelphia, with the question marks that Tim Legler and I have been articulating, particularly about James Harden. Yeah, we could say your past performances, we can ignore that, we can shove that aside, but on too many occasions, it's proven to be relevant from the standpoint that either you live up to expectations or live down to expectations, or you just rise above it because that monkey is on your back and everyone, including yourself, are clamoring to get it off of you. That's all I'm saying. But definitely, you're absolutely right. The two of the three seed, the road through the East. Obviously, if you got the number one seed, the path is easier. It's true. But I do think there's something to be said about a potential game seven on your home court and how that might affect you.
Here's where I do agree with your answer to it. The 76ers, when you look at the roster, when you look at the coaching staff, to me, when we talked about consequences, if they don't make a deep play, yes, to me, that's the team that has to get to the conference finals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And when you look at Doc Rivers with a bunch of talented teams, has not been to the conference finals since 2012. Mm-hmm. Joel Embiid in his career has yet to get there. You guys spoke on some disappointing performances from James Harden. I think the importance of getting to a conference finals is probably higher for Philly than any of those other teams.
Yeah.
Fair enough. Yeah. Stephen A., orange and blue skies, baby. You see this blue I'm wearing?
Yeah,
it's for the Giants.
They got to get out the first round.
Jay Will said it was for Duke. Everyone's trying to claim it. Let's go. Right. Big performance at MSG. Julius Randle goes off for 57 at the Garden in a losing effort. The first 50-point performance for the Knicks since Melo in 2014. SA, how'd you feel seeing that type of performance at the Mecca?
Well, first of all, there's a couple of things that come to my mind. Number one, Julius Randle, I appreciate him so much because he doesn't miss games. He shows up every game. He didn't play that well when I was sitting courtside watching him against the Clippers in L.A. a couple of weeks back. But damn it, he shows up. And I give him so much credit for that. And I think that obviously he deserves strong consideration for being on an all-NBA team. I definitely think that's the case, not just because of his availability, but because of the kind of season that he's having and the kind of season that the Knicks are having. Here's the flip side, and this is just me being in, let me just confess the legs, and J.J. Redick, remind you, you're talking to a lifelong Knicks fan, a lifelong suffering Knicks fan. I see something like this, and here's where I get worried. That's going to elevate Julius Randle's confidence even more. You know, dare I say, potentially lead to him being so confident he ain't think about passing and giving up that damn basketball. And in Tibbs' case, don't mind handing him the ball to be that dude that's making decisions with the game on the line. And sometimes that makes me very, very nervous when it comes to Julius Randle, because he makes a lot of tough shots. There's no doubt about that. He's ultra aggressive. He plays at 100 miles an hour. Only knows how to play at one speed. And sometimes you got to know how to dial it back. You got to have that poise, that decision maker, captaining the ship. That's my concern. But I was happy to see him perform like that last night. But it does say something to me that they still lost the damn game.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough. Hey, Molly Karam here, and thanks so much for listening to the First Take podcast. Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part, each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code TAKE. That's code TAKE. Visit vividseats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats. Experience it live. Hey, hey, I'm Molly Karam, and thanks so much for listening to the First Take podcast. You can now stream the most MLB games on DirecTV without a satellite dish. Yes, catch the clutch hits, strikeouts, grand salamis, web gems with nothing on your roof. So whoever's up there, whether it's roofers, Santa, birds, old-time chimney sweepers, moody teenagers, thrill-seeking raccoons, you name it, they won't find a satellite dish, but you will find your MLB games on DirecTV. That means DirecTV is your home for baseball this season. Root, root, root with nothing on your roof. Yes, stream your team. Call 1-800-DIRECTV or visit DirecTV.com to sign up today. Claim based on the total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Thanks so much for listening to the First Take Pod. Have a fabulous day.
Brought to you by the Capital One Venture Card. Earn unlimited double miles on every purchase every day, and you can use those miles on any travel purchase. Plus, earn unlimited 5x miles on hotels and rental cars booked through Capital One Travel. Your next trip is closer than you think with the Venture Card from Capital One. Terms apply. See CapitalOne.com for details.
All right, Stephen A., we're going to transition now to the NFL. We'll bring in Keyshawn. So the Panthers traded up to get the number one pick, and though they signed Andy Dalton, are still looking for that franchise guy. Carolina, one of the few teams, though, that could realistically make an offer to Lamar Jackson, who was given the non-exclusive tag by the Ravens. Here's their GM.
Like anything, like, you always have a conversation. We were looking. He's a great option. There's a really expensive option, but we're focused on more of the draft picks at this point.
All right, that was their GM, Scott Fitterer. So it sounds like the Panthers are out on Lamar based on that. Jackson and the Ravens continue to not be on the same page for a long-term contract this offseason. As I mentioned, the Ravens placing that non-exclusive tag on Lamar at $32.4 million for the 2023 season. The two sides have until July 17th to reach a multi-year extension before that number becomes permanent. Someone who knows about being the number one pick. Where is he? There he is. Hey, Key, how we doing?
What's up? How you doing?
Good, good, good. All right, I'm going to start with you. Tell me this, Keyshawn, do you believe the Ravens and Lamar can repair that relationship?
I do. And the reason I say that is because the relationship, look, it's negotiations. And I think all of us have been through some sort of negotiation in our life, and we didn't like what we initially heard, no matter how long it took. But eventually we got to where we met and we said, hey, let's work it out. It got deals got done. And we went on, for the most part, to be happy camper. And I think in this situation with Lamar wants to be in Baltimore. He just wants to get paid, compensated fairly, what he believes his market value is. And the Ravens right now see something different. And they don't have, they got all the time in the world until July 17th to make a major decision. I don't believe that the Baltimore Ravens are going to go into the regular season without Lamar Jackson as a starting quarterback. If he doesn't sign their franchise agreement by July 17th, he cannot play for the Baltimore Ravens at all. Now, remember, they franchise tagged him, but he has to sign the agreement. If he doesn't sign the agreement, he's not the quarterback. He's eating up the salary cap space right now at $32 million. So it's very difficult for them to sign high-priced free agents that's left in the marketplace to expand the talent level. And come draft time, they've got to be able to be at a certain number come draft time to be able to sign their drafted players. So in the end, I still think Lamar will be a Baltimore Raven. Teams don't want to get involved because they don't want to negotiate for the Ravens. They've had conversation with the Baltimore Ravens at the NFL Combine, at the Senior Bowl. They know what Ozzie Newsome and company's thinking. They know, hey, if we offer Lamar $260 million, they're going to match it. If we offer him $270, they're going to match it. It's going to take a number that's so out of this world for the Baltimore Ravens not to match, and no team is willing to do that because then they would have to put themselves on the hook. So if they decided to give him an offer sheet, that particular offer sheet eats up their salary cap space, so they can't sign free agents. They can't sign their draft picks. They can't address their own potential free agents in the future while they're still negotiating with Lamar. Lamar takes that offer sheet, goes back to the Baltimore Ravens, and the Baltimore Ravens is sitting on it. Now those teams can't do anything about it. So, look, in the end, it makes perfect sense for him to get his money in Baltimore, for him to stay right there.
You make salient points. I can't deny that. I just disagree respectfully. And I tell you why. Because to me, it's not a matter of can he show up to work and play for the Baltimore Ravens. To me, that's not repairing a relationship. If you're stuck with a team, you're stuck with a team. They put the non-exclusive franchise tag with you, which, as far as I'm concerned, has built-in collusion. It basically dissuades other teams from making you an offer because they're confident that the team that you're playing for is going to match it. So why put themselves on Front Street? We all know that that's the situation. And I think Lamar Jackson knows that too. Here's where I'm coming with this. I don't think that he'll ever be happy representing that organization again. That's what I mean when I say my answer to this question is no. Could he show up to work because he has no choice? Sure. Collect the $32 million that the non-exclusive tag gives him? Sure. Show up for his teammates who he's got love for? Yeah. But I don't think that he'll ever have the respect, the affection, or the affinity for the organization that he once enjoyed. That's what my no means, and here's why. Keyshawn, you brought up a negotiation. That's fine. We've all been through it, no doubt about it. There is a difference between not receiving the offer you want and feeling like you've been disrespected. There's a difference. When you feel you've been disrespected, that changes everything, especially when you hold on to it for as long as the Baltimore Ravens has. Look, Kyler Murray, forget Deshaun Watson, that's an outlier. Kyler Murray got $189.5 million guaranteed. According to Lamar Jackson's camp, who called me, they say the most he's been offered in guaranteed dollars was $133 million, which they consider a grave insult. Nearly $60 million less in guaranteed dollars than Kyler Murray. And they said that was the last guaranteed offer that they received. If they're lying or not, I don't know. I'm just telling you what the brothers told me. At the end of the day, here's the bottom line. If they are telling the truth, it is disrespectful. Then I got to take into account how J.K. Dobbins called out Harbaugh on his decision making in terms of not giving him the football to run it in when it was ultimately fumbled and returned by Cincinnati for a touchdown in the postseason when they was on the damn goal line. You don't hear anybody in the past calling out Harbaugh like that. You've seen the wide receiver Bateman go at DaCosta on Twitter before he had to ultimately pull down that tweet because he was upset that DaCosta tried to call out the wide receivers. You don't see a their general manager doing that, and you certainly don't see a wide receiver barking back at them the way Bateman did. Not if you're in Bateman's position. He's no scrub. But he ain't no damn Keyshawn either. So let's understand that. These things that transpired where Ozzie Newsome, who's supposed to be retired and just has emeritus status within the organization, has to come out front and center and be quoted as speaking on behalf of the organization, sort of like bringing calm from the storms per se. Why? Because DaCosta wasn't doing that for you, and the organization seemed to be unraveling. So the Baltimore Ravens that we once knew, that we once had the most highly and profound respect for, now has thrown some stuff in the mix where you're looking at them organizationally. I'm not talking about talent on the squad. Organizationally, in terms of their relationship with players, and you see something is awry. And then we take into account the fact that you got players clamoring for Lamar Jackson to be signed. They're going like this, yo. His brother's a former league MVP. 45-16 as a starter. And this is how they rolling up on them. You know, you got all of this going on. And I think when you have that kind of residue that exists, Keyshawn, certainly, if he has no choice, he's going to go back to work and get that $32 million in all likelihood, unless he elects to sit out the whole season, which I think is something he should consider. But at the end of the day, I think the respect and the adulation that he once had for the organization, I think that has evaporated for all the reasons that I articulated.
Look, I don't think you get your money and you win. All the other stuff, nobody cares about all that. He's going to be celebrated in Baltimore once he steps on that field. He gets his money. Now, you are correct about the $133 million. That is the most money that they guaranteed him. Now, Lamar talked about it only being 3 years, $133. He wants a little longer contract on the guaranteed side. So, I believe that they will work it out and they'll get the deal done. And I also believe that if the relationship is strained to the point where the organization is feeling a certain way and Lamar is feeling a certain way, money and winning will fix all that once they get there. It'll fix it all.
Yeah, absolutely. Winning cures all. And again, they have until July 17th to reach a deal. If he plays under the tag, it'll be for $32 million this season. First Take continues to celebrate Women's History Month throughout March. Here's a message from our own Chinee Ogumike.
Without question, my favorite women's sports story that I got to see live was the Women's Soccer World Cup in Vancouver. I had two young women that stayed with us for a couple years when they were playing for the Houston Dash in the NWSL. And they were on the World Cup team, Megan Klingenberg and Morgan Bryan. And to see them compete and ultimately win the gold medal was something my family and I will never forget. We had so much pride in what they were able to accomplish. And we saw up close all they put into their sport. Truly a magnificent time to watch them bring home the gold medal.
Hey, I'm Molly Karam, and thanks so much for listening to the First Take podcast. Have you ridden an electric bike yet? Well, you need to check out Lectric e-bikes today, the number one selling e-bike in America. Two things stand out that bikers love about Lectric. Number one, the majority of their models come pre-assembled, so you don't need to be a bike savant to ride them. Number two, Lectric wants to empower riders to more exploring time outside on their bikes, so they've made range a priority. Long-range batteries allow riders to hit typically around 65 miles of range for up to 150 miles on some models. Bonus, Lectric has purposefully priced their bikes to be affordably awesome. So you don't have to break the bank to get these sweet rides. See why people who have made the switch to electric bikes have fallen in love with biking again by visiting lectricebikes.com. That's L-E-C-T-R-I-C ebikes.com.
First Take fans, listen up. Have you heard you can listen to episodes of this very show ad-free on Amazon Music, included with your Prime membership? That's right. All your favorite First Take episodes can be heard on Amazon Music ad-free. But that's not all. You can listen to other top podcasts like The Low Post and PTI ad-free as well. They also have favorite shows like The Daily, Part of My Take, and Up First, all without ads. You know what this means? Uninterrupted listening, so no more cliffhangers. Amazon Music offers the most ad-free top podcasts so we know they definitely have something for you. And it's already included in your Prime membership. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app for free or go to Amazon.com/First Take. That's Amazon.com/First Take to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Molly Karam, and thanks so much for listening to the First Take podcast. Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
The NFL draft is just over a month away, and as teams shore up their teams in free agency, eyes now look toward the new additions that can be added in the draft. The big news is the Panthers are on the clock after trading two first-round picks, two second-round picks, and receiver DJ Moore to the Bears for the top choice in this year's draft. So who will they take? Our own Mel Kiper Jr. gives his opinion on his latest mock draft released today. Mel has Carolina taking CJ Stroud and also predicts another trade with the Colts moving up to take Kentucky quarterback Will Levis. He has all four of the top QBs in this class off the board by the fifth pick. Very unusual, and we will get into that. Where's my guy? Mel Kiper Jr. Mel, always good to see you, sir. How are we doing?
Good to be with you, man.
Good, Molly. Good, Stephen. Hey, great to be with you guys.
Okay. Absolutely.
Mel, tell me this. What makes you believe the Panthers are taking Stroud over Young?
Molly, I just think when you look at Frank Reich and what he wants in an NFL quarterback in terms of the size, the accuracy, 70% C.J. Stroud was the last 2 years, very few interceptions like Aaron Rodgers. He does not throw picks, C.J. Stroud. The Georgia game, the combine, we'll see pro day, we'll see the private workouts, how that evolves for C.J. Stroud. But right now, he's riding a wave of momentum. If he can bottle what he did against Georgia and carry that into his National Football League career, being that dual-threat quarterback, he could be special. So C.J. Stroud right now, because of Bryce Young, only being 5'10 and a quarter and a manufactured 204 pounds is the reason why for Frank Reich in Carolina, I think C.J. Stroud may be the best fit.
Mel, let me chime in here because I got to tell you, I hear what you're saying about C.J. Stroud. I'm in no position to disagree with you. All I could tell you is that when you talk about the momentum, he wasn't the only one that's been gaining momentum. I've been hearing a lot about this kid Anthony Richardson out of Florida. You've got him 6'4", 244 pounds, signal caller. That's what he is, okay? And it's the speed obviously can't be ignored as well. Coming out of the University of Florida, playing in the SEC. Talk to us about him in comparison to Stroud and Bryce Young.
He could be the best of this group with Will Levis, Kentucky, also in there, Stephen A. Yes. And I think you look at Anthony Richardson, I saw him against Utah September 3rd, and he looked like the number one pick overall, guaranteed. You could put it in 10. He was phenomenal. I mean, his legs, the way he can run the football, he's going to be an elite running quarterback right away. He showed the big-time arm strength. He was making accurate throws. He was doing everything. Next week against Kentucky, he's at 40% with a couple picks and not the running threat because Kentucky designed their defense to shut him down and frustrate him. So his accuracy, missing layups, easy throws, needs to change, needs to be fixed. But you can't teach or coach that kind of talent, Stephen A. So I'm with you. Whether the Raiders or somebody wants to move, I almost projected the Raiders to jump up to 3, but I said Indianapolis go from 4 to 3, get the quarterback. Arizona didn't have to move out of the Will Anderson Jr. Sweepstakes. They could get a corner maybe if they move down, but not the pass rusher. That's the reason why I went Indy, not Raiders moving up.
Well, the only reason I asked about him, Mel, is because in your mock draft, you got him at number 5 with Seattle via Denver, right? And I'm saying right. If you're a top 5 pick, then why couldn't you be a top 3 or a top 2 or maybe even number 1? I guess I'm looking at it from that perspective. When you talk about C.J. Stroud, because yeah. I look at Bryce Young, and he's just so small. That's my issue with him, Mel. It's the size and it's the fact that we saw what happened to Tua this year, and you're starting to look at some of these quarterbacks particularly getting concussed. Their size. I'm worried about that. Not worried about that so much with Anthony Richardson. Not worried about so much with C.J. Stroud. Is it likely or highly possible that they could go 1 and 2?
Anything's possible. At this time, a few years ago, I would have never thought Baker Mayfield was going to go ahead of Josh Allen. So anything can happen. There's no question about that. I didn't think Justin Fields would drop as far as he did. It's a mixed opinion on a lot of these quarterbacks. And certainly with Bryce Young, as you say, being an outlier, Stephen A., with that size, Will Levis, Kentucky, people have forgotten about how great he was in 2021 before he was hurt this past year and banged up behind that bad offensive line at Kentucky. So I think you look at it, it's wide open. You're going to have a lot of, like I say, mixed opinions. But for Anthony Richardson, Seattle, I think, would be perfect, Stephen A. They have their quarterback in Geno Smith. He could develop behind Geno. It's a win-win. If Geno puts together a great year after great year, fine. That's what you want. If he doesn't, then you're swinging for the fences with Anthony Richardson. They had Joe Flacco when they drafted Lamar Jackson in Baltimore. They had Alex Smith when they drafted Patrick Mahomes in Kansas City. So Anthony Richardson needs time. He's a one-year starter at Florida. That's it. And we know he is not right now an accurate passer. That needs to change. But the talent is in abundance. I think Seattle would be the perfect spot to allow him time to develop as a raw quarterback coming out of college.
Don't know much
can
about
Will. Can I get
Will
in here?
Go ahead, Bali. Go ahead.
Yeah. Will Levis, I know you had the Colts trading up to get him, but I wanted to get into Jalen Carter real quick. He pleads no contest to misdemeanor charges of reckless driving. He looked a little out of shape at his pro day, wasn't able to finish his position drills. You still have him going sixth, though. Mel, talk to me.
Molly, Detroit, you have Aiden Hutchinson on the edge coming off a great year, and now you have that interior disruptor in Jalen Carter. He's the best football player in the draft, Molly and Stephen A. Obviously, teams have to do their due diligence on the character and the off-the-field issue and that moving forward. But to get him there where they're picking at six, teams from five where Seattle picks down to Philadelphia 10, everybody there could use a Jalen Carter. So I think he goes in that area. I thought Detroit would be an ideal situation. They really addressed the secondary with Mosley, Sutton, and Gardner Johnson. Now you added three DBs in free agency. You can go away from that spot and go to an interior disruptor. As I say, with Aiden Hutchinson coming off that great rookie year on the outside, now you could Carter on the inside. Now that Lion defense, which was not real good, right, has to be a lot better. The offense was good. Defense wasn't. Now the Lions can build on what we saw that last year, particularly late, and now become a legitimate playoff team because the defense should be a lot better.
I completely agree with you, and let's not forget the fact that the NFC North is up for grabs. First of all, Kirk Cousins is quarterback in Minnesota. Something, an accident is waiting to happen there. The Giants beat them in the playoffs. And Chicago, obviously, you know, this is – I wouldn't call this a rebuilding year, but I will say this. Green Bay, obviously, Aaron Rodgers going to end up a Jet. That's what we all anticipate. Let me ask you this. Chicago gave up their first overall pick, two first-round picks, two second-round picks, and a player. I wanted to know, I haven't had a chance to speak to you. What were your thoughts about that, them making that move? I liked it. A lot of people thought that, you know what, they got a haul for that number one overall pick. They did what you're supposed to do when you're giving up that number one pick. I applaud them for that. But what do you think that's going to materialize into, not just for them, but obviously, forget about the Carolina Panthers. We know what they're going to do, or we think we know what they're going to do. What do you think about what Chicago did?
I loved it. Once you knew you had your franchise quarterback in Justin Fields, and people were trying to debate this, trade Justin Fields and draft a quarterback. No, when you have your guy and they know Justin Fields, what he can do, and they also have the maneuverability, guys, next year, if Justin Fields doesn't develop, to make a move to get Caleb Williams from USC or a Drake May from North Carolina. So this is Justin Fields' big year to make that quantum leap, as we've seen with quarterbacks over the years do exactly that. They're getting them some help now, adding players, obviously, in terms of wide receivers. I hope Chase Claypool can step up. You got DJ Moore coming in, okay? So all of them, and Cole Kmet at tight end. Now you got to get the right tackle. You got to get a Paris Johnson Jr. from Ohio State, Broderick Jones from Georgia to help Justin Fields, give him a little bit more time. He does hold the ball a little too long. He needs to work on that. But I think this is a kid now that allowed them to make the deal. If they would have had another quarterback that did develop, allowed Zach Wilson, they couldn't have made this move. But having Justin Fields, hitting on Justin Fields, allowed this haul, as you say, Stephen A., to happen.
Mel, thank you so much for being with us. And obviously, you can dive deeper into Mel's mock draft tonight on ESPN2, a SportsCenter special, Mel's Mock 3.0. That is at 5 p.m. Eastern.
I'm watching it. I'm
going to be watching it, too, and taking notes.